From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. We got a lot of mail about a recent show we did with Tom Moon and his book, 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. It's a music discovery book and the best bathroom reading of any music book around. Tom would take that as a compliment, I think. So today, Tom returns with more musical choices to hear before you die. We'll talk about recording gems Tom discovered by dumb luck. Also music like the tune you're hearing now by the Dave Brubeck Quartet, Blue Rondo a la Turk, that actually led him to the recordings of saxophonist Paul Desmond. And our third category, music that Tom Moon didn't think would make it in his book, but to his surprise, did. So one of the things that happened last time when we did this, Tom Moon, was we got reaction to the music that we played, and one of the things that we got the most excited reaction from was probably the most subdued piece of music, was the Erik Satie music. And although, you know, a chunk of our audience has heard Satie, a lot haven't. And I thought it would be nice to start us off gently here as we pick stuff. Let's start with music that you sort of, what you call dumb luck discoveries, right?
For lack of a better term, yeah.
And I'd love to start with the Czech composer, Leoš Janáček.
This music is so beautiful. Well, you know, you're taking stuff in from all over when you're looking for just great music. And I spent a lot of time listening to the radio and sort of scanning through radio stations. And on one public radio station one evening, I heard this piano music. I'd never heard anything quite like it. It does resemble Satie a little bit, but it's almost even more reflective and has a little bit of the Romantic era sense of melody in it. And it's just... This guy was a heavy.
What are we going to listen to?
This is the opening of a 14-section kind of suite called On an Overgrown Path. And with him, I get the sense that he wrote programmatically. In other words, he was thinking about certain sort of settings. And you can hear that this piece, it sort of has, first of all, a little bit of a pastoral quality to it. And so you're out in nature, and you definitely feel that he's somewhat trying to describe going on a path that you don't necessarily know where it's going to lead you.
And Leoš Janáček wrote this music in 1905. And this is Czech or Moravian. And let's listen to it. This is gorgeous. Gosh.
Yeah, all that, the melody, very simple line repeating the same thing over and over, and underneath it, these beautiful chromatic sort of counter lines that are snaking around. It's quite interesting, and you know, people say, oh, solo piano music, it's all just sort of beautiful in a very pretty, placid way, and when you really take it apart and listen to it, there's a lot going on inside there.
I love it. Another solo instrument, not too much later, maybe 15 or so years later, Blind Blake, ragtime guitar music, another one of your dumb luck discoveries. How did you stumble upon Blind Blake, and why don't you tell me about this finger picker?
Well, you know, you think in categories sometimes, and I definitely knew starting out this project that the book had to represent a certain amount, sweep of guitar music. And, you know, the early blues, you sort of can get some great guitar playing out of that, obviously Lonnie Johnson, people like that. But I was wondering if there weren't even people before that. And so as I'm reading the liner notes to one of the Charlie Patton records that I had. It happens to be like a little booklet inside the booklet that has covers of other records on the Yazoo label. So it's like a, sort of a little ad for Yazoo. And
and they're a label known for great finger-picking guitar music.
Yeah. And just early recordings. Right, early blues, early gospel recordings. And they've done great work cleaning up old records. And one of them's Blind Blake. And I'm like, I never heard of Blind Blake. I better find out about Blind Blake. And stumbled upon this record called Ragtime Guitar's Foremost Finger Picker, which, of course, whenever you get a record with a title like that, you're like, all right, bring it on. Let's hear it. Foremost, you know, essential, the best ever kind of thing. Is this guy really that good?
Well, let's hear him. Sounds like he was in the shower.
I know, right? No overdubs. Yeah. Let the record show. Pre the era of overdubs right there.
And it's sort of, I mean, that kind of music you mostly heard on piano, isn't that unusual? Maybe I'm wrong, but isn't that unusual for guitar?
Sure. And to be able to sustain the rhythm at that exactitude like he does, I mean, every quarter note is chopped exactly right. I mean, he's nailing it.
I've never heard of him. So this is great. Blind Blake, one of your dumb luck discoveries. I'm talking with Tom Moon, the author of a just remarkable. This is the Christmas book to give anyone who likes music without any question. 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. Tom Moon, this is part two that we've done. We had so much fun doing part one. We brought Tom back. Tom, of course, writes for All Things Considered. He and I have worked together for years. And I've just been thrilled to be going through this book and finding page after page, music I've never heard of, and then hearing Tom's take on music I have heard. We've come to task on a few things, but on the whole, that's okay.
And that's good.
Yeah, that's true. There are 1,000 things. There literally are 1,000 recordings in this. On someone else I never heard of in your book, tell me about a fellow named Hugh Mundell.
Yeah. This is his debut record. He's a reggae artist. I think he was 19 at the time he made this. And he's one of these guys who, you know how some artists acquire the ability to speak about social issues and they grow into their social consciousness as artists. This guy had it from the beginning. Hmm. And he has this record, Africa Must Be Free, by 1983. And he was really very much feeling the situations in Africa and just oppression in general. And being a kid in Jamaica, certainly knowing something about what was happening, racial exploitation and black-on-black violence is a huge idea for him. He talks a lot about that on this record. And, you know, to realize that he was so young doing it is mind-blowing to me.
And when did he do this? Because this is Must Be Free by 1983, but he was long gone, wasn't he?
He died in 83 while sitting in a car. He was murdered. So all the talk about black-on-black violence was in some ways prophetic.
So he's 16 when he does this. This must have been late 70s, 78.
Yeah, they came out in 78, so it was probably recorded 77. And the record was produced by Augustus Pablo, the great producer of some of the early reggae and dub records, sort of a dub founder. And you'll hear that Mundell is not necessarily the most accomplished trained singer, but boy, you can tell he believes what he's singing.
And this is called?
Yeah, this song is called Book of Life.
We'll take all these cuts, we'll put them up online, and so you can hear the whole songs there. I'm talking with Tom Moon, the author of 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, and that was Hugh Mundell, song Africa Must Be Free by 1983. Tom Moon, you sent me a list of some of these discoveries that you came upon, these dumb, what do you call dumb luck discoveries, and I that's a great way to put it, things that you just sort of stumbled upon, yeah? Well, many years ago, I got a letter from somebody, you know how people just find an artist, latch onto them, and that's it. This is their artist. And this fellow, and maybe he will hear this and write me again, because it was a wonderful back and forth, was in love with the music of Jimmy Spheeris. And Jimmy Spheeris was someone I knew from back in the days. I used to work in record stores, and I used to hear his records. And they were really unusual, sort of maybe Laura Nero-y kind of. How would you describe Jimmy Spheeris?
Yeah. Well, he's spacey, but he's got this great arranging sense. And so that he's a singer-songwriter who's sort of taking it very slow and easy. But there's often stuff going on around him that's very interesting. He had a beautiful, laconic voice. And he became a Scientologist after, like, his second or third record. And his later records have, like, other Scientologists of the day, Chick Corea and some of the people that played in Chick Corea's band, play on the records, and they're much busier, and they're almost jazz fusion-y a little bit. But the early couple records are just wonderfully quiet and introspective and lyrically very different from everything else that was going on in the early 70s.
Let's listen to a song. What do you want to pick?
Boy, almost anything on that record works well.
Which is called Isle of View. Is that the record you're talking about?
Yeah. The Isle of View is his debut record, and he was signed by Clive Davis back when Clive Davis was at Columbia, and people had high hopes for him, and I don't know that his records ever really, I think one of the later ones did okay, like had a commercial moment, but I don't think they ever really caught on commercially. It's astounding because this record, almost all of it is beautiful, and you could hear it certainly on, you know, sort of singer-songwriter radio, adult contemporary radio, whatever they call that now, adult alternative.
Well, it was good FM stuff. You'd hear him late at night, you know.
I bet that's right. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. You want to play Come Back?
Yeah, let's hear Come Back.
Okay.
Spend the night and the morning here. We talked, and once I even kissed you. choked up by fear. And yes, I'm sorry I missed you. But come back, come here, come back here, come back. Left me here and took a cab uptown. Left me with my feathers and my wine. I told you there were two ways to go. Go up or go down. And the time wasn't making you.
It is kind of important to understand the context of someone like Jimmy Spheeris, because it can seem a little wimpy, but at the moment in music when this was being made, music was frenetic, you know, and psychedelic, and it barely held together many times, and folks like this, and the reason Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young all started doing well was sort of the contrast they were. And Jimmy Spheeris was really the polar opposite of a lot of the guitar-driven jam bands that were happening at the time.
Yeah, he was in his own little spacey universe off to the side. And, you know, that track doesn't show it, but a couple of the other tracks have really interesting string arrangements by David Campbell, Beck's father. And there's a story, I don't know if it's true or not, that actually Beck as an infant was brought to sessions. And among them, these sessions on these Jimmy Spheeris records. So his very early musical gestation was right, you know, right there.
That's a pretty cool story. We should find out if that's true or not. I like that. Let's stay in the same era, but do something that you were talking to me about, which was how you were sure you would do a given record, but then you got steered somewhere else. And
yeah, that happened a lot, which is great and was one of the great joys of this project, where you'd listen to something and go, or you'd approach something thinking, okay, this for sure is one of these sort of pillar records that everybody has to have. And then you put it on and go, well, do they really belong in the time capsule? Is this really that good? And, you know, sort of a lot of check your head moments like that. And out of those came some great surprises.
One of those in that era was Moby Grape, which, you know, Moby Grape was certainly an underground band. I mean, they didn't sell a gazillion records. They got a big push from their record label, but didn't particularly do wonderfully. Why don't we give some context to it? We'll play a little of the song Omaha, one of their better known songs. And then, and then tell us the record after you listen to this that you decided to put in its place in the book. So we get the idea that's Moby Grape, you know, in the style of bands that you may know better, you know, someone like Jefferson Airplane or someone like that.
Yeah.
So you dug into Moby Grape, you got a couple of records, and what happened to you?
Yeah, and I thought for sure that the record that has that track on it would be the one. And, you know, at the same time I was listening to the Nuggets Box, which is also in the book, just hearing one of those kind of blasts like like Omaha after another. And I was like, you know what? People are going to find their way to that in a way. And then I started to look at what happened to the guys from Moby Grape after. And one of the songwriters was Alexander Skip Spence, who had made a solo record that called Or that people
O-A-R, right?
Right, O-A-R, right. that people had said over the years was one of these great lost gems and something that people should really hear. And I was like, all right, well, I don't know this record at all, but I'm curious enough about Moby Grape, and I'm thinking that that's the probable, like, you know, the doing the rock critic duty kind of record. But let me just, let me take a couple other steps. And I put on Or, and Or is a very different kind of record. It's him solo with sometimes lots of different stuff going on in terms of the arrangements. And it's, at the same time, it's just riveting writing. And some of these songs I thought were like, you know, sort of crazy genius kind of images, and again, not necessarily polished like a pop record from the heyday of pop music or anything, but still very interesting and very different track to track. So that, you know, if you were thinking in that Moby Grape mindset, you might be disappointed by Skip Spence, but I was more fascinated the more I listened.
Do we know if this is before the Thorzine or after the Thorzine?
It's actually after. Or no, wait. It's just before.
They sort of carried him off like shortly after
that's
this
right.
record, right?
Yeah. That's so right. Yeah, basically this is the last thing he does, yes.
Okay.
Before he is in Bellevue and basically never makes music again after that.
Hmm. What's the song we want to hear?
Oh, we could do, you have War's Peace?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's
okay.
It's a joy to know your resting peace.
This is what, 1969?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I've, in the both the Jimmy Spheeris in this and the Moby Grape, you got to listen to this on headphones if you weren't, rewind. The production value was so different. Stereo was really stereo.
Yeah.
I'm going to put this guitar in this room over here.
Yeah, and that the way the reverb on the voices, that sort of echoey vocal thing that he does, it's like, yeah, you know, he's definitely heard George Martin and the Beatles, but he's also sort of taking it into his own kind of crazy place that isn't psychedelia in the way of Jefferson Airplane, but it's really some other kind of sound.
Mm-hmm. Pink Floyd was the closest thing I can think of when I heard
yes.
that.
Yes, and Sid Barrett, the Madcap Laughs,
absolutely.
Which is, you know, mentioned a lot as a sort of twin to this record for obvious reasons.
And in A Thousand Recordings to Hear Before You Die, yes?
Yes, well, no, actually it's mentioned as a next stop here, but Sid Barrett's record is not in the book.
Oh, Tom.
I know. It's another one of these things
Let's put another... Let's just hack a little mark in the stone here for Tom.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's another one where I love that record.
Yeah.
And I found myself sort of fighting against some of my own favorites because I wanted to represent such a range. The two of them are very close, this record and or the Skip Spence and the Madcap Laughs.
By Sid Barrett.
Sid Barrett.
Who was the inspiration and member, founding member of Pink Floyd. Just
yeah.
for anybody who sort of missed that decade and era or that century. And another one, let me just take you to task on this, because this surprised me, and it's not like this is my favorite record at all, but this was sort of, you know, there are 1,000 records, and you figure that this one would make its way in. Let's just hit it. So that's obviously Dave Brubeck and Paul Desmond, and the record, of course, is Take Five. It has sold probably more cars
yeah,
than anything.
Sold a lot of cars.
And sold an awful lot of records. It was, you know, it was the jazz record of its day. And
It was a jazz hit.
Yes, that's right.
The rare jazz jukebox hit.
And it's not in the book. So what happened?
Yeah. Well, that's another one where I went out looking for it and ended up somewhere else. First of all, the tunes, the Brubeck and Paul Desmond, his saxophone player that we heard there, wrote are incredible tunes, Blue Rondo a la Turk and others. And often Brubeck's best contribution is in the compositions. And so I put on this Brubeck record that I think is just sort of like an obvious choice. I'm hardly even thinking about it. I'm listening to it, and I'm realizing, here's Brubeck. Everyone else is playing great, and Brubeck's sort of throwing elbows into the thing. And when Brubeck plays, it doesn't swing very much, and it's actually sort of distracting. And I'm listening to it in a new ears, kind of going, wow, I thought this was one thing, and I'm misremembering it, and it's not hitting me that way at all. So then I'm like, well, that's terrible. You know, I had to really check my head about that thought. And I started to listen to Desmond, particularly in other surroundings. And I found this record, found a couple of amazing Paul Desmond records. First of all, he made a lot of good records. He's one of those sort of undersung jazz artists who really thought a lot about the shape of a record and everything else. Anyway, he makes this record a couple years after Take Five. It's called Take Ten. And it's, you know, obviously, it's a bald remake of the hit, and they're trying to have another hit.
Mm-hmm.
But this time, instead of doing it with Brubeck, he's doing it with Jim Hall. And Jim Hall, the jazz guitarist, is one of the most swinginest and understated and very gentle players, just an amazing accompanist. And when you hear Take 10, you go, wow, this is even better than Take 5. Maybe twice as good.
Right. There you go. Well, let's listen to some of Take 10. This is, and the thing to listen for in this record, as was, it's so gorgeous to hear that 1959 recording from the Brubeck Quartet, mm-hmm. was the tone of the saxophone. And that's the guy who wrote the melody here, and the guy playing it, Paul Desmond, the song Take 10. Thank you. And you play sax, right, Tom?
Yes, sir.
What makes...
Not like that, unfortunately.
What makes that tone? What makes this tone so great? What was it?
It feels as though everything he's playing is an extension of just his normal breathing. It's not like he's having to force a lot of ideas into the horn or a lot of air into the horn. It's just everything's just flow. And I love the fact that he takes his time and he's not an overpowering player. He's very there's an intimacy to what he does that he's bringing you into it all the time, you know, and you can hear him from a distance and just be sort of curious about where is the sound coming from? And it's on one hand, very quintessential, like, oh yeah, that's a jazz sax sound right there. But on the other hand, it does have that quality of being like sort of the ether and not even really all there.
So we're now talking with Tom Moon about, as he wrote the book, 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, how you'd go for these obvious nuggets of music, things that you were sure they're in the canon, you're sure they'd hit the book, and then you thought, well, actually, here's something that I've down the path that is even better. There's a fellow by the name of Cal Jader. People might know him. Sort of a weird pop song in the middle 60s called Soul Sauce. At least it was in New York. I don't know if that was true of anywhere else. He's a percussionist. Is he a marimba player?
A vibraphone.
Player, sorry. And I guess Soul Sauce was one that you were after, yeah?
Yeah, and for a long time, I made the assumption, and assumptions are just terrible in a project like this, but I sort of thought, well, we got to have one of those sort of wacky mambo lounge records from the 60s. We have to, something in the book needs to represent that sound, and Soul Sauce did it. It sort of had a little bit of that soul jazz vibe, and when I listened to that, I was like, I got to hear some more Cal Jader because I loved the sound that he was getting. And the band, it's sort of like Afro-Cuban, but there's a little bit of a sensibility of jazz, as we said. And I was like, you know what? He had to have done some other things. And it turns out he was one of the few gringos that Latin musicians in New York loved to play with. And he really understood the Latin rhythm and made very credible, very highly energetic records for years. And one of the ones that I landed on through a DJ friend of mine, Aaron Levinson, who's a record producer and disc jockey and knows a ton about Latin music, he's like, oh, well, you got to pay attention to Cal Jader with Charlie Palmieri, a great pianist in New York at the time of the heyday of salsa. And they played together on this record that was released in 1970 called Primo. And it's just electric.
Well, I don't know. Should we play some of Soul Sauce and then...
Sure.
So people might say, oh, yeah, that song. And maybe they'll say, what the heck are you playing? But maybe they'll say, oh, that song. And just for 20, 30 seconds, and let's play this thing that he got turned on to by Cal Jader, the vibraphone player. Watch you water. Chihuahua. There's a radio station in New York, WMCA, I think, that used to play this song all the time. It was sort of off the wall, but it was fun. So that was that. And so now what are we going to play?
Right. That was recorded in 64. So we, you know, we hear him then in 1970. And why don't we hear Gringo City? Because later into that tune, both Palmieri and Cal Jader really, really rip out. They're great solos. Thank you.
Having some fun.
But it's just percolating along, and you know, great to hear the Rhodes played with that kind of attack, the Fender Rhodes electric piano.
Yes. Man. What is that tune that they stuck in there, the little novelty? What is that song?
I don't know.
It's driving me crazy. Someone tell us. Write to us at allsongs@npr.org or throw it. We now can people can comment on the shows that we do on the web, which is really cool because it used to be that we have to figure a blog post out in order for people to write about something they were thinking about that they heard on our show. And so often there was just no avenue. Or they'd write me personally and I'd write them back and that would be that. So now on our webpage, at the bottom of a page, so you'll see all the listing of songs that we're playing on at npr.org/allsongs, you'll see comments. And all you got to do is register your name. And then people have these conversations that go on and we can answer questions and all sorts of stuff like that. So it's nice. So that tune, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. What is
someone
it?
Will have that. Someone in your audience will That's have right. that. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. So one last category. Let's just pick a couple of things to go out on here. Things that you completely wrote off as, this isn't going to make it in the book. But then it did.
Well, and, you know, there again, I kept having to maintain this open-minded idea that I knew very little. And, you know that going through your day. But putting something like this together, I really, that was hammered home every single day. And in the case of this, the Bad Brains, I was like, you know what? Bad Brains, it was great. It wasn't, you know, I loved Minor Threat. And I can remember reading on the sticker on the Minor Threat CD that one of the Beastie Boys says, oh my God, this is the best record ever. And that made me think, well, that'll probably be it. But let me go back and just, before I make that determination for real, let me go back and look at the Bad Brains one more time and listen to the record that when they stopped being, you know, exclusively a punk band and they started to really sort of branch out, well, exclusively anything. Were they ever exclusively anything? Are they ever? But where they were trying to, like, sort of polish things a little bit and the production was a little higher. And the record I'm thinking of was called Eye Against Eye, which I remember liking at the time. And when I heard it, it completely flipped my paradigm about the band. I was like, wow, I did not remember how good this was and how intense it was and how strong of a record and how solid and fully baked the writing was. It's really a great record.
Did you say flipped? Is it the word flip that you use? Because what's his name? HR, who was the lead singer of the band. I saw them when they were first getting going back in D.C. in 77, space that I think was called Madam's Organ because it was in the neighborhood called Adams Morgan.
Adams Morgan.
Right. And this was in a storefront of a place, and gosh knows how they wound up playing in this place, but I wound up being there. And he would do these amazing flips while he's singing, just completely flip his whole body around and land on his feet. And gosh, they were so amazing. And I'm glad you picked them. I'm glad you picked them. Let's listen to this. This is the title track from that Eye Against Eye that you chose, and we'll listen to the Bad Brains.
feel mad that you just don't see it. Never stand, I open empty anyone else. So tell me your why, is it after the line? Trying to make me up confused about the USA. When the fact in my mind that you just don't hear, to comprehend, I overstand, I see your words. Mother, what am I going in time?
I think they all had ADA.
Right, but the tempos change all the time. Grooves last only for a minute or two, but the transitions are so well nailed. It's like, you know, anyone who thinks like all punk rock has no accomplishment in it at all you have to do is play some of this record, because they are navigating some tempo changes and these moments where the whole thing stops and then starts up again. That takes work. I mean, that's musicianship there.
And these guys got together not as a punk band when they started. They got together as a sort of a jazz band that got turned on to punk music, and when music changes, they were something. Yeah. Or they are something.
Yeah, they're still at it.
I think I just been told that I said ADA, which is the American for Disabilities Act, and my apologies there. My mind is somewhere else, and it's they have ADHD and and I have a hole in my brain. I'm talking with Tom Moon, who wrote 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. Take us out on one more, Tom, and thanks for doing this again.
Turning people on to such
music that I think most people haven't heard, and this is the book to have so much fun with. It's, you know, you can read it little chunks at a time. It doesn't weigh you down, and you just every page you learn something. So pick me one more thing to go out on.
Boy, I don't know what you have there and what you want to.
Well,
what kind of vibe you want to have?
Let's stay with the theme of stuff you'd written off.
Okay,
and let's do something that's hip hop.
Oh, that's great. Well, this is not so much that I'd written it off. I just never appreciated this as a full album, and that's the Ultra Magnetic MC's Critical Beatdown album. And it was one of those things where I kept reading in interviews with hip-hop artists about how important this record was. And I was like, really? I don't remember it being so important. I remember it having a couple great songs. But then going back and hearing it, it's another one where years later, after contending with it and writing about it and covering them to some degree and then not thinking about them for years, coming back to it was a mind-blower. And they were one of these acts that never got the love for how much they for their contribution in terms of making rap that was popular, that felt like popular music, that had the energy and discipline of a pop song in it, and some ridiculously fierce rhyming at the same time.
Why do you think it is they didn't get the love? Is there any...
I think, well, they got the love within the community because, as I said, I was reading these interviews like a decade later, and, the rap artists were saying, oh, man, people don't recognize how heavy they were. And I was like, well, maybe I don't. Maybe I better go back. And I think they were probably too hip for the room, in a sense. they were certainly very different from, the LL Cool J vibe.
Great. Pick us a tune. And we'll go out on that.
Oh, let's hear Watch Me Now.
Okay, great.
It's too much fun not to hear that.
Thanks again, Tom Moon. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
The book is called 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. And if you missed our first interview with Tom Moon about his book, you can hear it by podcast or on our website, npr.org/allsongs. Also, you should know that on All Songs Considered's blog, we're asking you for the nominations for the best CDs of the year. We'll use the most nominated CDs to make up our ballot for the best CD of the year, and we'll close the nomination process around the 15th of November, and soon after that, we'll open the voting for the best CDs of the year. Please join the NPR community and register to vote by going to npr.org/allsongs, and then follow the link to the blog. And now, from Ultramagnetic MCs, this is Watch Me Now. I'm Bob Boylan, along with producer Robin Hilton for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
I'm better, but some don't believe me though. But I'm a pro in hot material on your Walkman. Box to any stereo, uno, dos, not cuatro. Spanish girls, they like to call me Pacho. On the mic, innovating this pattern. You fell off, your brain is on Saturn. Take steps and climb my ladder and climb, climb, climb. Pace the rhythm and clock the time that I leave. Come back on beat, different. Telling and selling, like a skyjet plane propelling, but dwelling. Deep in your skull, my rhyme shines and yours are dull like dirt. It hurt to be whacker, but instead I grab a big stacker. Whack MCs, lay them down like tile. Scrapping garbage, germs I pile to keep clean. I'm in a movie scene. Ears turn and needles ring to cut scratches in a part that matches. I'm leaving eyes and brains with patches stuck. So push my luck for any roach or empty duck. Just watch me.
I'm living large. My record's on the radio. Every day you hear me in your stereo. Rapping hard with lots of volume. You hear static? Well, use your fine tune knob to tune me in better. Cause I said G and I would never let her. Whack MCG off with style. Touch my mic, rip and smile like a duck. You know you all soft punk. Living pink, your material sucks. Louder and worse than you can imagine. You best run, cause I'ma put a badge in your brain. So you can see the real time. Grab a pen and write down my rhyme. And learn it and learn it and learn it until it sinks inside your skull and you're no longer pink but red. Cause now you are a biter. Learning from me, so I guess that is a writer. Except if you try to be the original. Rhyme imperial, the exceptional G. Sometimes I rhyme offbeat, awkward, but different with the rhythm. Back and forth, 1-2, and then I give them a chance to see the world's greatest MC. Just watch me. Word up, you gotta watch me now. More love, release the glue.
I'm continuing back and forth. Your brain spins facing north and south and west, not east at an angle. But mine's dango, where's your kango? It seems weird, your head is triangle. Like a mango, something I snack on. A soft duck, something I smack on. Every day, when I come outside, you step back, stay inside your house. While you look out your window, your girl screams, where cool keep go? Walking, while punks keep talking. Annoying me, MC's hawking. On the stage, anytime. I'm cold chilling or wearing a rhyme to keep warm with the beat that's playing. You hear me now? You know what I'm saying to you, you and you. Your whole organization and crew just watch as I enter your mind. Decorate and paint my sign. I'm hazardous, so scatter this around. I'm cool, keep knocking MCs down. Just watch me and him.
Rhythm with madness. I have to have this chance to rock again so you can hear this over and over and over until I'm finished. Hey, but I'm not. So here's a rhythm, a rap beat, step beat, keep feet happy as we gradually, slowly will teach all how to rap. I will attract all the deaf girls, smack the ugly ones back and sit as I chill. I'm drinking Moet, expensive champagne, cause that G is a poet. Rapping and teaching, reaching levels higher. Don't wanna be king, so don't call me sire, but instead a scientist with a breakthrough. My rap is funky, it can't relate to you, him, her, your little brother, his older sister, your baby's mother, cousin's aunt. Your whole family. In other words, said G, I'm amply the best producer.